New research explains why people spend more money than they should. And in this week's On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley will tell us the reasons as well as the connection between money and happiness. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll also cover the pros and cons of a new kind of retirement account and the best ways to get discounts on online purchases. As always, Kevin will have answers to your personal finance questions. If you have one, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So a recent Wall Street Journal article highlighted the reasons that I spend more. Why we spend more and have less. What's the story here, Kevin?
The article was compiled from several different academic papers, and it discussed why we don't budget as well as we should, why we may be misallocating savings in regards to debt, why we are spending when we shouldn't, how money and happiness interrelate. And there are several good points in here, but we do have a few points of disagreement with some of the findings.
So what did the researchers find?
Well, first of all, we're not good at planning expenses. We're great at planning income because we generally know how much we're going to get paid, but we're not good at planning expenses. And not surprisingly, we typically underestimate what we're going to spend. The Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision Making at the University of Colorado Boulder, or as many of us know it as the CFROCFDMATUCCB, you just use it for shorthand. A lot of people have heard of that.
Yeah.
They researched the phenomenon in a forthcoming study for the Journal of Marketing Research. What they found is that people think about income, and they know exactly what that income is going to be, especially if they're not self-employed, if they have a steady paycheck. But they don't focus on rising expenses. And what they found is that a lot of people who are going to make more money tend to spend more money in anticipation of that rising income. And then not only do they spend more money on a planned basis, but then there are extra expenses along with those, such as, you buy a new house, and you figure out what the mortgage payment is going to be, but then you don't get figuring the extra property taxes or how much it's going to cost to mow a bigger lawn or remodeling that you have to do as well. They also found that in another study from the University of Stanford University and the University of Zurich, they found that people with low willpower tend to reward themselves for exercising that willpower because they think that it's finite. They say, I actually did something that was really good for me. Therefore, I'm going to spend some money to reward myself. And people who believe that willpower is infinite, meaning that it's something that you can always draw from, were better off at not rewarding themselves. They just said, hey, I don't deserve a reward for that. That's something I should do and I can do in the future. And so their suggestions are that if you are going to reward yourself, try to find some way that doesn't involve spending more money on yourself or making a good decision. And you can limit cash on hand by only carrying a $20 bill around wherever you go, hide your credit and debit cards if you have to, and stay off the computer and stay out of the stores.
You mentioned, Kevin, expenses associated with homeownership and that and remodeling, and that just reminded me of the bathroom remodel that that we're thinking of doing. Why does a bathroom remodel cost as much as my house cost when I first bought it?
That'll probably be really nice. And let's be honest, as economically sensitive as I appreciate you being by having your own composting outdoor toilet, it's about time to get indoor plumbing. The neighbors are complaining.
I'm still battling with this. So what did the researchers find out about happiness and money?
This was from the Journal of Economic Psychology, and they found that unhappy people tend to save less and tend to spend more and have a higher propensity to consume, and happy people exhibit the opposite characteristics. They are more future-oriented and pursue goals that will serve them better in the long run. And from my personal experience and watching how people spend and save, I would say that this is a chicken and egg theory at work here. I think that the better off people are in terms of their financial situation, the happier they are. And not all of us have total control over that, but those of us who are doing what we can and feel like we're on track, we're saving, we're not spending money on things that we shouldn't, and we're not jeopardizing our financial security, there is some happiness and some satisfaction in reaching that goal.
You did not agree with every study that was quoted in the article, though. Why not?
Well, there were a couple of issues that I had with this, and I have this a lot because I look at a lot of these kinds of studies and do a lot of reading and research just out of curiosity, but also how it helps in doing the show and my grown-up job as a financial planner. And I see a lot of where academics, they tend to judge things just on paper, and they don't have enough experience in dealing with real people in real situations over long periods of time and understanding how people work. And for instance, one of the things they said, there was a University of Chicago School of Business study. They had a theory that they said saving money makes people feel financially responsible, but then when they start accumulate money, it leads them to accumulate too much of it at the expense of paying off debt. And they said in the study that people, you know, would build up 6 months, a year's worth of savings, and they wouldn't slide that over and use it to pay off their mortgage or home equity line of credit or credit cards. And there's certainly some benefit to that, to reducing the interest rate. But when they made this study, it was during the economic crisis, and a lot of people were a lot more worried about losing their jobs or losing money on investments than they were about paying a little bit of interest, especially a little bit of interest on a low rate like a mortgage or a home equity line of credit. And that little bit of interest that they pay above and beyond what they earn is kind of like an insurance premium that you pay to make sure you have access to your cash whenever you want it. And if you're concerned about losing your job, you should have a lot of savings on hand, at least 6 months and hopefully a year's worth of living expenses to cover you in the event of the job loss, or it could be some other uncovered emergency like a medical expense, or you have to help a family member out. So I think that people should pay down debt as they can, but I don't think they should sacrifice their savings as well. And then the other issue that I had with it, there was another study that that came out where they talked about how people were tapping their home equity lines of credit and for the wrong reasons. And I do agree with that. I don't think you should spend money on a depreciating asset, or you should borrow money from the home equity line of credit on a depreciating asset. But generally, when you have to reinvest money into your home, especially if it's a matter of, you know, just upkeep, like, you know, staircase is wearing out or the carpeting is just shot, when you borrow against your home equity of line of credit to pay for that, yes, your net worth goes down, because usually when you spend it on the home, it doesn't go up automatically in value for the amount that you spend it. You might only get a 50% return in value. But there's some benefit to the intangible experience of having a nicer home, of having something that's more comfortable, that feels better about it. So, again, I'm not a big fan of tapping a home equity line of credit unless it's an emergency, or if you're trying to avoid taxes by pulling out of a retirement account, for example. But if it is to reinvest in your home and it's a sensible expenditure, like a bathroom, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I do want indoor plumbing and a shower that works. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, let's take a call now from Stephen in Madison. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
All right. Hi, Kevin. I have a question. I am putting away money for my son for his college. He's 8 years old. I have it right now in a Vanguard mid-cap fund. I'm thinking about switching it over to a small-cap fund because I have like a 10-year window. Would that be the smart thing to do? Because the mid-cap fund is really not making any money.
Well, not making implies an object in motion. And what you probably mean, Stephen, is that it hasn't made as much money in the recent past, right?
That's correct, yeah. It's
okay.
Like,
okay.
It's been the same for like a couple of years.
Yeah, and that's generally not the fault of the fund. It's typically the problem lies in with what they specialize in. And unless there's some other phenomenal mid-cap fund out there that's done great, typically this is a good indication that area probably hasn't done well. And you'll find that in a lot of other different kinds of investments out there. The problem that I have with this is you're moving from something that's pretty aggressive into something that's very aggressive. And that might be good if things go really well over the next 10 years, both in the economy and in the stock market. But my guess is that's not going to be the case. And you may be setting yourself up for even bigger losses with moving to a more aggressive fund than if you were to stay with the one you're in, or better yet, move into something that's more conservative. If you are going to go to the small cap fund, Stephen, here's something I'd recommend. In the college savings accounts, are you using like an Edvest or something?
No, I'm not. I have it actually in a Roth.
Oh.
That I'm going to pull out eventually and use it for his college education.
Okay, and just so everyone's clear, you can pull the contributions back out of a Roth IRA and use it for anything you want at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. You pay earnings, or you pay taxes and penalties, rather, on the earnings portion of the account, but the IRS lets us designate all the withdrawals as contributions until we've matched how much we put into it. So just so you know that is possible. It's not always the best way to do it, but I like that strategy for a combination kind of saving for retirement and saving for college. Here's what I would do is if you're going to go with something that's even more aggressive, balance it out with something that's more conservative. They have a money market or even a certificate of deposit or something that's going to not pay very much, but it's not going to lose very much in bad times. And then if you rebalance those on a 50-50 basis, you'll still get some performance out of it, but it'll smooth the ride out a little more. And more importantly, you'll avoid big drops, which 10 years is a long time on paper, but it'll be a very short time in terms of both your child's growth and in terms of the investment horizon.
Wow, so you think a mid-cap is too aggressive, right?
Maybe. I mean, we're near an all-time high in many asset prices right now, and the likelihood of a vast outperformance over the next 10 years is probably pretty small, and so I would be cautious about being so aggressive with it, especially if it is you need it. And the other problem with it, Stephen, is that you do have 10 years, but unlike using this money for retirement, you're going to use this over a very short period of time, so you really only have about a 14 or 15 year window total. So in this case, I'd rather have you err on the side of caution rather than too much aggressive.
Stephen, thanks for the call and good luck. You know, Kevin, I don't remember hearing the terms mid-cap fund versus small-cap fund. Maybe I wasn't paying attention.
That's probably the case. No. Small-cap fund means companies, it stands for smaller capitalization. They're generally smaller companies. Capitalization is the value of the company, like anything under, I will say, $1 billion. A company worth $1 billion technically is probably a small-cap company. And those companies are generally less stable, but they may have more chances for growth as well. And so, therefore, the prices in the stocks may have more chances for growth, but also have more risk, too.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Coming up after the break, we'll discuss the pros and cons of a new government-sponsored retirement account. And we'll take more of your calls and your questions for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, talking about issues that matter to you when it comes to your money. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's an email from a listener named Richard who says, "Thanks for the show and all the useful information." Very good, Richard.
Yeah, and he only likes the useful information. There's not a lot of that, but yeah. Thanks for singling that out.
If an annuity is held in a Roth IRA, can the tax-free interest from the annuity be allowed to accumulate in the Roth IRA indefinitely? And can the accumulated funds be invested in CDs to generate more tax-free interest?
Okay, let's start with the first question, Richard. It's not indefinite. With Roth IRAs, there is no required minimum distribution while the owner is alive, even after the owner reaches age 70 and a half. But if and when the owner passes away, then the beneficiary, if it's not a spouse, has to begin taking distributions out of the Roth IRA at his or her life expectancy at least every single year. And the distributions are mandatory. If it's not taken out appropriately, there's a 50% excise tax on what should have been taken out and wasn't, but they are tax-free. And then also with many annuities, the insurance companies write in a provision in these contracts that the owner or the owner of the Roth IRA, the beneficiary, has to begin taking money out of this and annuitizing it at a certain age. And so, no, the answer to this is both with an annuity and a Roth IRA, the money can't accumulate indefinitely.
What about can the accumulated funds be invested in CDs?
Yep. That is definitely a good idea, again, especially if you want to keep it conservative and safe. You're not going to make much on it, but you're not going to lose much either. You can use a Roth IRA to buy a CD. You can do it at a brokerage account like Vanguard, Schwab, or Fidelity and just buy a brokered CD within it. Or you can just go to a bank or a credit union, and most of them offer Roth IRA CDs.
All right. Thanks, Richard, for the email. If you'd like to email a question, it's onyourmoney@WPR.org, or you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Vivian in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Vivian.
Oh, excuse me. That last question sort of leads into my series of questions, and I know I get the right answer. So, I will be 70 and a half in February, and I have no emergency fund. And I've been withdrawing from this small IRA that I have. It's about $20,000. That's served as my emergency fund. But now when I start the RMD distribution, I don't know if I can still treat it that way and take out larger sums if, for instance, and I had a huge car repair bill. And then if I institute the RMD at 70 and a half, could I postpone the first distribution for the 12-month window and take the first distribution at 71 and a half because I've instituted the RMD?
All right. Well, before we get too many questions on the table, Kevin, can we get started?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't listening. Vivian, could you just repeat that, please? No, these are very good questions, Vivian. Thank you for asking. And the rule of thumb and the rule of law for the IRAs is that you have to take the balance of the previous year for required minimum distribution purposes. You have to take the balance of all your IRAs, and then the IRS has a divisor figure they want you to use, and you divide the balance by that figure, and that's how much you have to take out at least. But you don't have to take it out until April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. So technically, your first RMD for your IRAs, Vivian, won't be due until April 1st of 2017. All right? And so you will have to take another one in December of 2017. But as long as you're taking out some form of money in a $20,000 IRA, the first year's distribution is probably going to be somewhere around maybe about $600, $700, somewhere in that range. And so as long as you're taking out at least that amount, it doesn't matter when you're taking it out during the calendar year, it doesn't matter why you're taking it out, just that you take it out and you technically add it to your taxable income. You may not pay taxes on it because you may not have enough income to pay taxes, but it is taxable income. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Very, very well.
Okay, did you have anything?
Thank you.
Was that it then? All right, thank you very much, Vivian. Good luck to you. Let's go next to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. What I would like to know is my daughter is in college, and I have approximately $10,000 in my savings account. And that's the only debt I carry is I owe about $60,000 on a maybe $100,000 house. Should I try to, before filling out the FAFSA next spring or in January or February, should I try to get rid of my savings elsewhere before I fill that out? Will that change her benefits?
No, that's a good question, Karen. In the worst case scenario, a parental asset, which is what your savings will count as in the expected family contribution, it's called the EFC. When you fill out the FAFSA from a need basis, only about 6% of your parental assets will, at the most, will count in that expected family contribution formula. So if you have $10,000, the formula will ask you to contribute $600 before any need-based aid kicks in. And from your own personal situation and from your daughter's situation, you are much better off having that money available to use for an emergency, to help her pay for uncovered college costs, whatever, rather than trying to qualify for more need-based aid. So no, do not jeopardize that savings at all, and especially just to try to qualify for more financial aid, because it really won't make much difference.
Well, the only thing I would have done with it is perhaps put it towards my mortgage, but you think it's, I'm at 3.85%, which is really not bad, and I'm probably just better off keeping my mortgage than depleting my savings towards my mortgage.
Absolutely. Okay. And especially in the sense of getting more set up for emergency expenses, again, we'd like to have you have at least 6 months and hopefully a year's worth of monthly expenses set aside in a readily accessible liquid savings account. And so I would keep building that up rather than trying to pare it down to pay off the debt, especially with a very low interest rate on your mortgage.
Good luck, Karen. Thanks for the call. Justin in Winona, Minnesota is with us now. Hi, Justin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah, my question is, well, I spent a lot of my younger years not necessarily doing the smart thing with my money, and I'm 37, you know, I have a 8-month-old baby, and I'm really looking to kind of set up retiring, and I have an opportunity to put in 401k in the company that I'm with. I'm just wondering if that's actually smart at this stage in the game, or is there a better option for me possibly for investing for retirement around 65?
Yeah, I'm guessing a lot of the listeners are chuckling along with Joy and me of the notion of 37 being old and
yes.
Wasted my youth, et cetera. Justin, a lot of us would give many things to return back to age 37. And good for you. You're still considering this stuff at a very young age. And the fact that you're thinking about it all, especially when you have a new baby in the house, which is certainly probably affecting your time and your finances and your sleep and your stress level. So good for you for figuring out this. Yeah, the 401k is the best thing you can do to save for retirement for the long term, especially if you get an employer match. But even if you don't, putting in pre-tax contributions to a 401k will generally lower your tax bill in the year of the contributions by about 10 to 40 cents for every single dollar you put in there. So you get an immediate savings for it. And it's not like you're spending the money or giving it away. It's still your money. So yes, I would definitely put in as much as you can afford to put into the 401k. If you're concerned about getting access to the money in an emergency, you may want to instead use a Roth IRA, because you don't get a tax break on that, but you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties, and then it's tax-free in retirement. So if things are really tight for you, the Roth IRA is better. If you feel like you're paying more in taxes than you want to, then do the 401k instead.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you, and congratulations on the new one. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. It is time now for Smart Assets. A new government-sponsored retirement savings account is finally available to workers. Tell us about it, Kevin.
Well, it's been in the works for a long time. It's called the MYRA account, M-Y-R-A, stands for My Retirement Account. It's a voluntary arrangement where you can have money put in from all different kinds of sources, and it's kind of like a Roth IRA. Again, you don't get a tax break on the contributions, but it is tax-free, and you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties at any time.
Great. So what are the benefits of the MIRA?
It's very simple. There's just one investment option. It's the government G fund that federal employees can use in their retirement plan, and it's basically a kind of an interest rate fund that pays about 1 or 2%. Very low investment minimum. You can put in almost as any dollar amount, $2,000, what do you want. There are no fees on it. It's very flexible. Again, you can have a payroll deduction put in from your employer. You can use your savings. You can even have your tax refund directed into the account. And then you can move it to another Roth IRA, whatever you want, or again, pull the money back out if an emergency dictates that so.
And the downsides?
Downsides are that there's really only that one investment option. If you're looking for more reward and can handle more risk, you're going to have to look elsewhere. Also, you can only accumulate a maximum of $15,000 in this particular account. People in higher earnings brackets can't contribute to it if you make over $131,000 as a single or $193,000 as a married couple filing jointly. You can't, but by the way, you shouldn't. You should be using a pre-tax plan like a 401k or an IRA instead. And the investment option, again, it just doesn't pay very much. So it's nice, it's safe, it's very secure. You're not going to see a significant amount of savings on it, though, as time goes on.
So what do you think, Kevin? What's your take on the MIRA?
A very nice gesture. The problem is definitely there. According to the National Institute of Retirement Security, the median account balance of working age households in America of retirement accounts is $3,000, meaning half of the people have less than $3,000 saved for retirement so far. Half do have more, but $3,000 isn't going to cut it. So it's a nice idea to try to get people an easier access to it and not have them worry about losing money in the stock market. But there are already lots of investment vehicles out there, like Roth IRAs. It's great because it will be hopefully boosting up the savings rate, but a lot of people aren't saving for retirement, not because they don't know how to do it or because there aren't any vehicles. It's because they just don't have a lot of extra money set aside to do that once they pay their bills and pay their health insurance, et cetera. But if you do want more information, you can go to myra.gov, myra.gov, and we'll have the link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Time for more questions from listeners. And Tony in Green Bay is with us next. Hi, Tony.
How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. Well, I work full-time. I got a really good pension. My wife works, like, part-time, but she also gets some cash work for working also, which is non-taxable, non-reportable, which kind of stinks for Social Security. But we're just kind of wondering, you know, since there's no taxes on that cash money, what would be a Roth or an IRA? What would, or just contribute more to my stuff? You know, what would be best?
Well, Tony, I have good news and bad news for you. The good news is if you adhere to the letter of the law, that cash actually is reportable and it can be taxable. And so you do actually have to report it, even if it's not from a specific employer or if it's from, you know, cleaning, babysitting, mowing the lawns or something like that. If it's income, it's still reportable and technically still taxable. But once you do report it, it will go on to your Social Security for your wife. And then she can use it as the basis for a contribution to a Roth IRA, which is what I would suggest that she do.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Now we move on to Scott in Wausau. Hello, Scott.
Good morning.
Hi.
So I've recently taken a new job, 45 years old, and looking at a 30-year mortgage on a new house for the relocation at 3.85%. And the question is, my new mortgage is $600 a month less than my previous mortgage. Do I sink the $600 a month in the principal payment of the new mortgage or invest it hoping to get a higher interest rate?
Yeah, it's going to be tough to get a higher guaranteed rate than the guaranteed rate of the 3.85%. Scott, are you maxing out your 401k contributions at your new employer?
Yes.
Okay. And are you married?
Yeah.
Okay. Is your spouse maxing out contributions too?
She will be once she becomes eligible at her new position.
Okay. Make sure you're maxing everything out that you possibly can. Keep in mind that in 4 years, you're going to be 50, and so you're going to be able to put even more into that account. I would just as soon have you build up your savings with that account rather than paying off the principal. And once you get to the point of having, like I said, 12 months worth of living expenses set aside and you're maxing out your contributions, then maybe I would start to slide that money over towards paying off the principal and reducing the mortgage debt. But that interest rate is so low that that's not going to be the end of your financial security by just paying that off over the 30 years. So no, I wouldn't do it in the way to try to earn a higher rate of return. I would do it because you are trying to maintain liquidity and safety and build up that safety net underneath you and your wife.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. Now, Bob in Middleton, it's your turn. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a kind of unusual problem. More than 30 years ago, I bought some stock, and over the years, due to stock divisions,
dividend reinvestment?
Dividend reinvestment plans, I have reported that every year on my income, but I have no idea. I'd like to sell some of it now, but I don't know how to figure out what tax I would be responsible for.
So do you have a record of all of those payments over the 30 years, Bob?
Yes. On my income tax, it would be, and I have kept all my returns.
Okay, great. Then all you have to do is add up what the dividends are and paid in reinvestments are. And it's outside of an IRA, right? This isn't in a retirement account?
No, it's not in a retirement account, and I'm not in desperate needs of the fund, but I would like to handle them more intelligently, I guess.
Okay. Well, the IRS rules are that you have to come up with the cost basis, and if you don't know, you have to use zero as your cost basis, which then means you can technically pay capital gains taxes on the entire amount. You don't have that problem because you have a very good record of what those actual purchases were. So you basically add up all of those purchases over all those years and then take your gross proceeds of the stock, subtract the cost of the purchases, and that difference is your capital gain. Now, the maximum you may pay on that for taxes is going to be about 20%. But I don't think people in the middle income tax brackets, meaning anything under 15%, generally don't pay any long-term capital gains tax. The long-term capital gains tax rate is 0% at the federal level. So what I'd like to see you do is maybe look at selling a little bit of it now in 2015 and then in a few weeks, it'll be January of 2016, and sell the rest of it then if you want. Then you split it between 2 years, and it makes it more likely that that you won't pay any taxes on it whatsoever or that the tax bill will be relatively low. And then last but not least, Bob, if you do any donating, you may want to donate those shares to a qualified organization. Then they sell it. There's no capital gains tax for anybody, and you get a tax break on the amount that you donate to them too.
Thank you, Bob. Good luck to you. Coming up, we'll take more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. After the break, Kevin will have some ways to help us maximize the discounts and cash back on our holiday shopping purchases. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Better shop around. Mm-hmm, you better shop around.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time now for our shop around segment. Whether you are shopping for the holidays or year-round, you should know about the ways you can get discounts and cash back on your purchases. So, Kevin, what are some of those ways?
Yeah, a few different methods you can use, whether you're shopping in stores or online. And you can get discounts right up front in the form of electronic coupons, or you can get cash back after you prove that you made this purchase. And it can really make a big difference, especially if, like the holidays coming up, you plan on spending quite a bit of money.
So what should we know about the discounts?
Well, for groceries, you can start with Favado, F-A-V-A-D-O, and that gives you automatic coupons toward purchases at most major grocery stores and lots of other items around in the big box retailers. And then Coupon Cabin and Retail Me Not also provide some really great coupons that you can use whenever you need it. You don't have to deal with, shuffling through the Sunday paper to find all those inserts.
Yeah, what about rebates?
without using paper. It's a really neat deal. Ebates is an online service that claims to have provided savings of over $325 million to its members. And you can either go online at the website and enter in different items you've either bought or are thinking about buying, and they'll either give you a rebate for it or a coupon towards the future purchase. And you can also get it on your phone as well, where you would carry your phone around, and then if you scan different things in, these different sites will tell you if there is a coupon available within that. And it's ShopKick, ReceiptPal, Ibotta, Saving Star, and Checkout 51. And I know people who have all of these on their phone, and every time they're going to make a bigger purchase, they go through each one of these apps and find one that will give them the best discount on it. And it's a nice way to do it without having to try to go find it on sale or try to shop around someplace else. And we will put links up to all these different sites up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds convenient, but are there some drawbacks to these programs?
There are a few. If you're downloading these apps, many times if you carefully read the terms of use, so a lot of times they'll say they're doing this because they want to help you as much as possible, but they're trying to get lots of information about you and your shopping habits, et cetera. So there is a loss of privacy because they'll know what you're looking for and what you're shopping for. And then many times, especially when it comes to the groceries, they don't do a lot with the store brands. It's more with a name brand and the highly prominent consumer products companies, which tend to, you know, maybe they have a better product, but they also have a higher price anyway. And so if you really you have an allegiance to a particular product, these are good to use because you will be able to save some money. But they're generally, the savings are on the more expensive versions of the products. And then there is the usability of the reward. Sometimes when these companies give you an Ebate or a coupon or a break on the purchase, they don't give you actual cash. They give you coins or gift cards or something that you then have to use. There are limits as to how you can use it again in the future. So they're a great deal if you already have something in mind that you know you want to buy. And you can use the reward in the manner that it's given to you, but don't buy it just because you get an Ebate or a coupon on it.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And time now for more of your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Rick in Nina is with us now. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Question. My wife and I are both retired. I'm 61. She's 64. She's collecting Social Security. We both are getting a dividend from our 401k, and I have a good pension. My question is, should I take Social Security at 62 and stop my 401 dividend, or take my wife's half Social Security benefit, which I've heard about, and wait till 66, or what's the best scenario there?
Yeah, it's hard to say for sure without knowing exactly the numbers involved with it, Rick. Usually you are better off just waiting as long as you can, but a lot of times people don't want to do that because they don't want to exhaust the savings. So I can't say for sure without running the actual numbers for it. If you do hang on, though, to the website of the week, we have a site that you'll be able to use to actually calculate some information. You put the information in based on your behalf, and it'll give you some better scenarios as to whether or not you should take Social Security now or later. I will say this, if you can live off the interest of your savings and not draw into the principal, you're probably okay waiting to take Social Security. And if you think you're going to live past 80, you're probably okay waiting to take Social Security. If either one of those things aren't true, though, usually it's better to take it sooner than later.
All right. Rick, hold on, and we'll have that website of the week for you in just 10 minutes or so. Jeff and Spooner is with us now. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Joy.
Morning.
Morning, Kevin. So I have a similar question of Rick. I'm in the Wisconsin retirement system, retired 2 years ago. My wife retired a year ago. I was taking the accelerated rate for about 3 years, Kevin. But at 62, that rate, that monthly check goes down to about half. So the question is, is it better for me to wait with taking Social Security till I'm 66? And supplant that additional income I need through my Roth, and then when my wife turns 62, take her Social Security and just continue to take out of our Roth.
Again, hard to say without seeing the actual numbers for it, too. I don't like the idea of depleting savings. It's usually better off to wait to 66. 66 is the magic age because that's full retirement age for most retirees, and that's where, you know, you get the maximum benefits, plus you don't have to worry about your earnings, any earnings you have in the future, being taxed while you're also collecting benefits as well, too. So offhand, if you need that money and you're going to notice this, the way human beings work, is that typically if you see that drop, even though you know it's going to happen, you knew it was going to happen when you signed up for the pension payment plan from the state retirement system, it's going to be harder to deal with. And so offhand, I'd rather have you just turn around and start collecting Social Security, and that way you won't notice the drop in income. But again, if you think you're going to live past 80 and you can do without the money, it's okay to wait.
Good luck, Jeff. Doug in Waukesha is our next caller. Hi, Doug. What's your question?
Hey, yeah. So I have a lease purchase on a home, and it's due up in about 6 months. And I was wondering, I have $50,000 to $75,000 in 401k and an IRA mix, and then I also have about $20,000 in stock. And through the lease purchase, I've put in about by August it'll be about $18,000 towards the down payment of the home. The group that I'm buying the house from is going to carry the contract at 4.9%. Would it be wise for me to perhaps take a loan on my 401k or take the emergency withdrawal and put it towards the down payment?
I'm sorry, Doug, do you have to come up with a down payment?
They'd like 20%, but okay. They'd be set aside with 10.
Okay. I would whenever you're buying a house, put down as little as you possibly can unless you think you're going to spend the money on something stupid. What I'd like to see you do is rather than going against the 401k, you said there's $20,000 you have in stock. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and that's outside of an IRA or 401k or anything?
Yes, it is.
Okay. What I'd like to see you do is if you do have to come up with money for the down payment, I'd rather have you sell the stock and use the money for that because you're already investing in something by putting a down payment in the house that is going to go up and down in value. And so that's just going to supplant the stock. And if you want to be in the home and you want to own it, that's the best place to get it. But I would put down as little as they ask you to, but keep the savings set aside for an emergencies either that come up with the house or if you run into a problem with your job or something. It's better to have that money set aside now and pay a little bit more in interest than to stick it all in the home equity and then have to try to draw it back out when you most need it.
Good luck, Doug. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Bill in Cumberland is with us now. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, Bill. Go ahead with your question.
Morning, Kevin. My question is this. I heard you talking about required minimum distributions and taking one in April, and then you'd have to take another in December. Does that have to be that way, Kevin, for everyone? Is there a way to avoid that of in our case, getting hit twice during the same financial year?
Right. No, it's a good question. It's a very confusing arrangement. And again, IRA owners are required to take distributions out by April 1st of the year after they turn 50 and a half. But if they wait until April 1st, as you have discerned, then you have to take another one that particular year. And the reason they have the April 1st allowance in there is because a lot of people forget, especially for their first one. They're not used to it. They don't understand the rule,
right.
And so they forget. So they give them kind of an extra a 3-month window to take that first year's out. But in your case, as you alluded to, you are probably better off from a tax standpoint actually taking it in the year you turn 70 and a half, the calendar tax year,
And
then you're only taking one RMD that year and then taking the other RMD the year after that.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know. I thought, oh, gosh, I have to wait until April because I turn 70 at the end of May, but I could take it that same year and not get hit twice then.
Yep, that's right. You can spread those out, and then it's every year after that.
All right, Bill, let's go to Dale in La Crosse now.
Good morning, Kevin. I attended a seminar on preparing for long-term care, and it went through all sorts of strategies for investing as well as spending money. And one term that came up was a modified endowment insurance policy. And the aspect of that was if you have a large amount of money in a current just plain savings account, which is paying very little interest, use a modified endowment policy, which would have the same liquidity as a savings account, but would pay much more interest.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have the same liquidity because it's a life insurance policy, really. And the other thing that it pays way more of is commission to the person who was probably putting on the presentation for you. And over the very long term, the modified endowment contract may be a good idea, but we're talking very long term, like 10 or 20 years. In the short term, they're not going to earn enough, especially if the policy proceeds or the premiums are invested conservatively, to pay all the commissions and all the expenses of administering the policy plus for the profits for the insurance company. So no, I would not choose that offhand as the first way to pay for long-term care. If you said, I just want to have some kind of long-term care insurance policy in place, I would actually just go out and buy a regular long-term care policy.
Well, we have that, so this would just be another source of getting better return on savings account.
Yeah, I'm always curious about how an insurance company, especially a new money in this environment, taking it in, can offer a better rate of return than treasury bills or banks or whatever pay. And still keep it safe. And so I'm very leery of it, especially if, you know, the one way around this is to ask this person who's offering this to you, what do you get paid if I put some money into this? And typically it'll be a significant amount of money. It might be 70% of the first years of premiums on top of this policy. And usually, sadly, that tends to cloud the judgment of many of the people who sell these things.
Yeah. Good luck, Dale. Patty in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead with your question.
I have about $5,000 in credit card debt and about $5,000 in savings, and I just wanted to know the best strategy for paying that off. And I can take the answer off there.
Okay. Well, you certainly can just slide your savings right over to the credit card debt, and the good news is you won't have any more payments anymore, and you won't pay any more interest. But the bad news is, Patty, is you won't have any more savings left. And so I would here's what I would do, is I would try to pay 10% of the balance every single month until it's paid off. And yes, you will pay a little bit more in interest with that strategy, but you will also have the remaining amount of your savings set aside so that you can use it whenever you want. And you'll really only have maybe one extra month worth of payment if you do pay it off at 10% per month, and try not to charge it anymore if you can help it as well. And the nice thing about it too is once you do get it paid off, you're going to have that available credit, hopefully, so that if you do run into an emergency, say you need a car repair or something, you'll be able to charge it back on that card. But again, just try to keep from charging it up in the future.
Thanks, Patty. Mary emails, Kevin, you are my favorite guest ever on WPR. That's good.
She's a very astute listener. Yeah.
The past 7 years, I have received about $3,000 a year for the RMD due at my parents' death. I don't need to spend the money now, and I have it in a CD. Should I have it in a tax-free investment since I've already paid taxes on the money, a Roth IRA CD, or what do you recommend? I have saved for retirement, but I have a mortgage and a college-bound 8-year-old. It's got a pretty smart 8-year-old.
Yeah, I would say. I guess I would have her put it probably in like a 529 college savings account. It's not enough money to make a huge difference in her life, but enough where accumulated over the next 10 years, it should be worth probably $30,000 to $35,000, and that'll pay at least a good year's worth of school for the 8-year-old. And if she uses the Edvest account, she'll actually get a small state income tax break on it. And ironically enough, that state income tax break for state of Wisconsin residents actually runs out after the first $3,000 per year is deposited. So that would be an elegant solution to that money. And she can keep control over it. It won't hurt them too much in need-based financial aid, but it would be a good destination for those funds.
Super. All right. Now for the much-anticipated website of the week.
Yeah, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, I think, is a really great agency. It's relatively new, and they've come up with a lot of neat tools to help people at consumerfinance.gov. But we've been getting a lot of questions on this now, and we're going to be getting more in the future, and we'll address it, but about how people should take Social Security, especially in light of the new changes to the file and suspend strategy and filing for restricted benefits. So you can go to the consumerfinance.gov website. It's actually consumerfinance.gov. yahoofinance.gov/retirement, and you can enter in some of your information anonymously, and it will spit back some different scenarios you can use to decide if and when you should take Social Security. And consumerfinance.gov will have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin will be off next week. We have a fill-in guest ready and lined up to answer your personal finance questions. That's coming up next week on Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.